ब्रह्मा चलोका दीपति सहम्पति कातांजलि अ दिवारं अयाचत सन्ति दशहता परजाकजातिका देशे दुरामा अनुकम्पि मां भज।
नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संपुटस्सा। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संपुटस्सा। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संपुटस्सा। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। Well, it's Sunday evening. Well, one of the questions that has come in is, what happens when your practice falls apart? What happens when, you know, you've put so much time into various, you know, skillful means and lived a good life and so on, and then just life gets really complicated or difficult or painful, and that happens. People get very, very sick, and they're, you know, get betrayed, and they're burnt out by having to care for others, and sort of the kind of not extraordinary extremes that we face as human beings. And it's very disheartening if, you know, somehow all your go-to places in meditation just aren't working. It's very, very disheartening. So I, you know, just contemplating that question, what's important for me is coming back to the basic principle of making conscious the way things are. So that's the way I talk about. I've been thinking, why don't I use the word mindful? I don't use that word very much. Maybe because it's so used that I'm not quite sure how people are using it anymore. So I don't want to be connected to whatever use they have in case it's not the same use I have, if you see what I mean. So then, you know, in terms of language, what I'm trying to portray is awakening to the moment without any desire in it. And without any necessary focus in it either. Just a simple, simple recognition that life is this way now. And that's easy to say, but it's quite hard to do, because quite often there isn't an awakening to the way things are. There is a resistance to the way things are, or wanting things to be different than they are, right? And these are very quick. The mind's very quick that way. These habits are very, very quick. And so the language I find I use, and so I talk that way, is I say, like when I ask you, make conscious the feeling in the mouth, say if we're doing body meditation. And why I use that is because it's not like a focus on anything, it's just recognizing there are these sensations. And hopefully that's free from desire. And if you get that idea in something very simple like a bodily sensation, and then encourage that idea with something like sound, then make conscious the make that just sound, then hopefully come back to the same receptive awareness, non-desire, non-becoming, non-resistance. That's all the language I use. So there's a kind of open attention to the way things actually are. And then I might say, okay, then do that with some negative emotion. And then it gets more difficult, doesn't it? Like a negative emotion, you might have a whole history of trying to figure it out, getting caught up in the storyline, thinking you have to fix it, blaming yourself. There might be a whole pile of stuff packed into the original arising of that. So it gets terribly complicated. And to come back to the simplicity that it's like this, to make conscious that, is I think what you always have to do, even if the meditation seems to be falling apart. And so if you start with that, then hopefully you see the resistance to the way things are in the case of things seeming to fall apart. And then actually saying to yourself, my meditation is pathetic, right? And this is what pathetic feels like. This is hopeless. And this is what hopeless feels like. The feeling of hopelessness is different than the thoughts that I am hopeless. And that's the key. It's the self narratives which are driven by, in this case, a feeling of hopelessness. And the feeling of hopelessness is very valid. It's a very valid feeling. And to say to someone who feels hopeless, to say it'll be all right might not be the best thing to say. Because for them, it's not all right. It's hopeless. And to actually help a person to make conscious the feeling of hopelessness, I think is a much more compassionate and helpful strategy. If you've ever had, you know, you're really feeling rough, really, really rough, and someone says, it'll change. Maybe that'll be helpful. Maybe you want to strangle them. Please don't give me a Buddhist stuff right now, you know? But if you say to them, God, that's difficult. Yeah, that must be really, really difficult. Then you're joining in their predicament. And then you can maybe dialogue and you say, well, yeah, that's really difficult. Yeah. That must produce a lot of thinking, yeah. And then you have a way of actually talking to them about and not being dismissive. Well, I think in the same way we have to maybe talk to ourselves or come to that sense of recognition that this sucks right now. sorry about my French. You know, to kind of really make that conscious, a really terrible feeling of betrayal or a hopeless feeling of like losing a plot or inadequacy or whatever it is, or nervousness or physical pain and all these things, part of the curriculum. So the problem always in Buddhism that we're trying to diagnose is not that not necessarily the unpleasantness of a difficult situation, but the desire not to have that. And yet what could be more natural than not want that? Of course you don't want that. But what is the choice? Once it has arisen, and sometimes the factors of complexity that we faced, so maybe someone's been betrayed in a really horrible way, or someone's had to deal with a sickness and illness for long, long periods of time, or chronic illness, or whatever. The accumulation of that creates huge things on our nervous system, and then the result of that's going to be very, very difficult. It's not going to be pleasant. But if we can get to the awakening to that, then at least the self-narratives which run from that, we won't buy into those so easily. So there's a huge difference between recognizing a feeling of hopelessness as an object, obviously, and running with the thoughts of hopelessness. It's and that's really what non-grasping is about. Non-grasping isn't some kind of magic wand cure that when you notice something, it's just going to cease. No, it has its own life, doesn't it? And if that life has been conditioned into the mind through very adverse circumstances, through no one's fault, just through the situations of life, then it's going to take tremendous patience and endurance to constantly just come up to witnessing. And what would happen then, it's easy for me to say this way because I'm quite happy right now. But I have had times where I've been just blindsided by difficulties and my psyche's just gotten out of whack. You know, just kind of, wow, where am I? And I'm like, there's no, there's no grounding anymore. What, you know, what is going on where nothing works? Nothing works except just running around trees or something like that. Or just walking. And until somehow some balance comes back again. But if then there has been a constant reference to awakening, and a reference to moral virtue and social responsibility and so on, if those are the framework one is working within, then you kind of get through it somehow. So I think of people who have like PTSD or these kinds of things. They're horrible because they're so real, you know, they're so very real. So if in situations of stress, you can say stress feels this way, right? Without trying to fix it, then there's some space around it. But the meditative attitude might be very quickly to try to fix it by going to the object of meditation and then hoping that the object of meditation will now rectify this problem. But the problem is that then it's a kind of pushing away, and that thing's not going to be pushed away. It needs to come into consciousness, and then it's very threatening. So the way of non-grasping is the way of knowing without all the narratives of thought. So the ideas of grasping or attachment in Buddhism is always around self-thinking. It's not about the experience itself. The experience itself is seeded by previous events, right, that now are triggered into consciousness or are constantly being triggered by circumstances. And then that's natural. That's neither good nor bad, but it is painful. And then the self-thinking picks that up in whatever patterns it does, like this is hopeless or I'm terrible or whatever you want. And that's what you have to work with. You have to work with the self-thinking and try to see, yeah, that's what the self-thinking is going on, but what's it really like, this feeling of, say, hopelessness? And then you're coming back to the grounding of the awakened mind, and you have to do that, until its power dissipates. And notice how the sense of a personality is just a thought, but it is a thought. So that, like, like I was saying about self-doubt, was it last night or whatever night, and that comes up, then self-doubt is a mood, it's a type of mindset, but it only creates a personality through thought. And if I can see that mindset and have that awareness of this self-doubt, then it has no fuel to keep going. It has the fuel of history. So if I've been a strong self-doubter for many, many, many years, then I finally get some space around it, then it'll come up a lot. But it only, the only problem with it, actually, the problem with it is the I thinking, me thinking, my thinking. And that's what we mean by attachment. So that's when we say this is empty of a self. That's the language you use. But that thought pattern is not really accurate, because it can be known as an object in awareness. So we're not saying there's no self, because there is, but we're not saying there is a self. We're just saying that this particular arising of horribleness in whatever way it might be is not it's not a personal essence. It's a natural phenomena, painful natural phenomena. And the running with it with thinking makes it worse, and is a wrong perspective, is a wrong view, is a wrong understanding, because that's not who you are. There is no personal entity in that. But it is personal in the sense that you're experiencing it. So what do we try to differentiate between is the way I think about it in terms of language, there is individuality, but that individuality is natural. It's natural functions coming through consciousness. And that none of that can be my real home. Whereas awareness knows that, I begin to see, well, that's what I can trust. That's what I can really trust. And each of us has an individual pattern, right? And so if you don't understand this teaching of anatta, or not self, then of course you have the the kind of Zen jokes where, you know, the guy says there's no self, and the Roshi kicks him in the shins, and the guy said, "Why did you kick me?" And he said, "There's no self. What's the problem?" Then it gets really silly, right? There is individuality, and there is the individual formations of mind-body coming through consciousness. That's natural. So the question is not so much how can I perfect personality, but rather how can I know personality as an object that comes and goes through the self-thinking. Once you start to not believe in the self-thinking, then these things aren't problematic. They may take a lot of endurance, but once you have trust and faith and in awareness of change in this way, then you've got a way of just being with it. And this is what we mean by emptiness in Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism at least. I think Mahayana uses the word differently, emptiness. Not emptiness of content, right? Not some kind of vacuity, emotional vacuity. No, that the sense of self that I'm identifying with is actually just a phenomenon in nature. And then you say, well, who am I? Who am I? Well, that's the ultimate question, which cannot be answered through thought because it's just more thought. You have to abide in trusting awareness. And then things become obvious. And then language just doesn't work anymore. So trusting in awareness of change then opens the heart to what Lompo Cha would say is our real home. Now, one of the things that Lompo Cha was very good at, he was very good at creating situations of frustrating desire. That was the thing he said was his method. When he was asked, "What's your method?" Metta bhavana, anapanasati, body sweeping, da 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 da. He said, "No." He used the word toraman, and toraman, if it's mistranslated, it means I misunderstood it to mean torture, and then I tortured myself. And then later on, of course, 20 years later, I found I was wrong. And then Ajahn Jaya sort of said, no, it means frustration. Ah, now you're telling me. So the idea with Ajahn Cha was that he would quite deliberately set up situations which were not harmful, but they were very frustrating. And the classics were about, you know, long talks. I mean, long. I mean, like 4 hours. And you knew darn well he was playing with you. And he would just in a talk say, "So why are you suffering?" "Because you won't shut up. That's why I'm suffering." And you just look at, well, what's the cause of suffering? Is it me talking long periods of time and your knees hurting and so on? Or is it that you want something else? You know, say, "I want to go meditate." You say, "Why can't you meditate here?" And he just kind of keep pounding at the Four Noble Truths that, okay, there is suffering right now. Yeah, you're suffering. What's the cause? Well, you. Have we ever said that to anyone else? If you weren't here, I'd be happy. And of course, yeah, Ajahn Chah was interesting. He was fearless. You know, he could have like 50 monks with burning eyeballs on, well, most of the eyeballs were closed actually, but kind of thinking, "Oh, please stop. Stop, will you?" And he would just go on and on and on. And what it did was quite interesting, because you'd just be in this sort of situation where it's really hard to meditate. You're on a concrete floor, mosquitoes are biting you, it's too hot. And you know, don't understand the language, and you just keep bringing up the mantra, "Why am I suffering?" It's because of attachment to desire. Attachment to desire. What's desire? Well, I don't want to be here. I don't want this pain, and I want to do the seal practice. And you know, you're kind of whinging to yourself, "Oh, what this," and then. And then sometimes you just break through. You'd say, oh, this is the way it is now. Oh, it's just this way. It's just pain. Or it's just boring. Or it's just mosquitoes biting. And hey, it's all right. You're not going to die. And that's actually pretty easy, really, because it's not like I'm stressed out with anything just except my own mind. But that kind of lesson was incredibly valuable, that over and over it's, well, what's the problem? And the idea of the Four Noble Truths, that there is discontent, there's lack, there's suffering, there has a cause, the cause is attachment to desire. The end of suffering is the cessation of desire, letting go of desire. And the path is the awakening to all of that through the various ways that the path is talked about. And it's very much a medical diagnosis. You know, you have a disease, and the disease is caused. And the prognosis, ladies and gentlemen, is good. There is health at the end of the tunnel. And that's the letting go of desire. So that's what you have to do in the contemplative life. You have to see, this is a situation. It's like this. And then you have to diagnose it. What do I want that I don't have? And what do I have that I don't want? And that's the contemplative query, a question, predicament. You know, what is the problem here? And it's not the experience that's the problem. And that's hard to get. Like the experience of sitting and listening to Ajahn Chah, you think, oh, you were with Ajahn Chah. It was always very inspiring. Not really. It doesn't work that way. If it was, I probably wouldn't have gotten any wisdom out of it. But what was the problem? The boredom or the painful knees or the mosquitoes or the lack of understanding or the loneliness? Was that the problem? Or was the problem that I didn't want those events happening? And once I understood that in that situation, then I could apply that methodology of diagnosis, shall we? To things which were more serious for me, like social fear. So then as I began to grapple with my own sense of fearfulness and shyness and sense of inadequacy and so on, that same paradigm began to click in. What's the problem? Is it fear? Yeah, that's the... No, that's not it. The fear has arisen. I can't do anything about it. What's the problem? It's the desire not to have the fear. Ah, okay. That took a few years. But once I understood that, then fear was kind of okay. It was very horrible, but it was kind of okay because now I had a way of saying, oh, fear feels this way. So getting to the point of saying it's like this is a huge step in itself, isn't it? It feels like this, because quite often the desire to not have it this way is very, very quick. And then from that, you get all the proliferation around that. So like if you feel worried about something, that's driven by fear. You don't see that. Then your thinking mind just drives that. And then you feel hopeless and you get depressed or whatever. It can go all kinds of ways. So this awakening to the way things are is actually very, very profound. And it's kind of the beginning and end of the path. Because as you take refuge in that awakened consciousness, you see, well, that is your home ground. So it not only liberates you from this entanglement with this stuff that we have to learn about, but also it in itself is home ground. And then what happens is then you get this kind of confidence that when the entanglements of greed, hatred, and delusion, and for me it was very much fear, come up, you say, well, this is a chance. This is a chance now, not only to purify the mind, but really make that refuge solid. Whereas before, it was exactly opposite, right? It was the thing that plagued me, the thing that crushed me, the thing that defeated me. And now it's become this kind of ally. Not that one likes it, you know, it's still unpleasant, but now you see, yeah, this is a really good opportunity. It really is. I'm not just being goody good about whatever the word is, you know, like, oh great, you're suffering, it's a growth experience, oh shut up. You know, You don't say that to other people, right? But you can say it to yourself if you're sincere, right? But it can be just a platitude that people then, you know, oh, another growth experience. Yeah, another growth experience and I'll be dead. So it has to be a kind of sincere understanding, an insightful understanding. But then when you see the problem is desire, this attachment to this changing realm that we have, and the liberation from that is the cessation of desire. So then with my own fearful responses to life, as I began to know them as conditions, I could also see the desire not to stay with it. I don't want this. I don't want this. But I stay with it. And the desire ceases, you see. And the desire ceases and the mind begins to have the open heart and the equanimity and quietness of the mind, because as the desire ceased, gone away. So again, those were my kind of travails and traumas. And now, obviously, I don't have to do that now, but that period when I got blindsided by very complex events, my meditation did fall apart, but there was something deeper. Awareness was there. I kept going. I kept, you know, being a monk and doing what monkish things in my kind of confused way. And people were concerned about me, and I was concerned about me, but somehow I just kept going. And I think what really helped me a lot was actually then taking care of my mother, because I was really floundering, and then all of a sudden my mom needed me, and then I had this kind of focus where it's just about service. It's just about service now, and that was really, really helpful. And then I had a kind of a very obvious objective of service, and a very beautiful object, love my mom. And that kind of really helped me a lot. But it was difficult. It was a really difficult time. And I'd been a monk for quite a long time, so these things do happen. But if you have a whole grounding in this understanding, then it's kind of functioning subconsciously, isn't it? We say the practice clicks in. That's what we sometimes say. But if one's never done this kind of work, then it can just be very, very confusing, because you don't have the sort of background psyche and background viewpoint to be with these things. So to that person that asked the question, I'd say go back to the kind of when all else fails, read the instructions. And the instructions are the Four Noble Truths. In the moment, not intellectually, but experientially, existentially. So what is it? What is it now? What's the desire? And then be with the confusion, be with the horribleness as an object in awareness. Again, it's easy for me to say, but kind of just to encourage that. Okay, I'll finish the talk there, and Ajahn Pavaro will do the recitation.
Angamayam uvadatam akata sadhu karam dadamasi.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Vivian, did we get any chat questions? Or...
I'm just looking.
We don't have any in our...
I don't see any my end.
There you go. Happy customers. We have a few moments. Oh, there was one question which was... We kind of lost it in the email trails. It was quite... It was a kind of question about technology and modern technology and neuroscience. Anyway, I'm not up on that stuff, so I really couldn't figure out an answer. But anyway, is there any question from the... There you go. Tori, would you like to pose a question, please? We'll unmute you.
Oh, okay.
There you go. You're unmuted.
I have a nerve pain that makes me have to meditate lying down.
Great.
And I'm wondering, should I try meditating sitting up just to work with that pain?
No.
No, okay.
No. You have gray hair?
Yeah, well, silver.
All meditation in seal posture is allowed.
Okay. Thank you. I really appreciated your spending the time and supporting that, because that's the only way I can meditate.
And you don't, you know, basically you're probably similar in age to me.
Yes.
And I don't know, my theory now is I don't want to stay in shape. I just want to stay roadworthy. If I can keep this thing running for a while longer. So those kinds of pains are quite serious, so be very careful.
I am. Thank you very much. I am. Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? Oh, Milena from Montreal. Can we unmute Milena? 1, 2, 3. You're unmuted.
Hi.
Hi.
Ajahn, I have a question about metta meditation.
Yes.
So it's obvious that when you do metta meditation, the benefits are right there and they're almost instantaneous. But I was wondering about the object or the person that you're sending metta to.
Right.
Do they receive, is there a fallback on them? Do the benefits spill over onto them?
Well, if you send them an email that you were sending the metta, they'll feel good.
Right.
If you don't send them an email, I don't know. So do both. Send metta and an email. You've got it covered. But remember that I don't think that's a particular, you don't find that way of talking in the texts. Because the thing about that, you're assuming that there are a you and a them. And in Buddhist philosophy, that's already problematic. Sorry. Anyway, not that I want to destroy your relationships. But at one level, and you feel really good doing that,
yes.
Right? And that's a lot. And then when you talk to them, that's a lot too. Other than that, I don't know. Now, so like, is your consciousness different than my consciousness? Is the knowing different? I don't know. Certainly, my knees are different than yours. And my haircut's different than yours. Yeah. But those are the objects. But what about consciousness itself? And is this, you know, and this is where thought, and for me, it just gets very, very mysterious. So I don't go there. But I've never, you know, when I started practice, I never picked up metta bhavana as a practice of sending out energy. That was never the way I learned it. The way I learned it was that the mind can be imbued with loving kindness by thinking of others. And when it's imbued with that, it becomes a powerful antidote to all forms of judgment, criticism, negativity. And then that is a way that also the individual energy can participate in society. But I never learned it like to send out metta to. And I don't want to be a spoil sport with this. I mean, go for it.
No, that's,
it works,
that's
right? But to me, that seems, it always seemed to me a more Christian idea, which is great, you know? Mm-hmm. But my sense of it is that the whole sense of individuality, I'm here and you're out there, needs to be somehow challenged if we're going to take this teachings on anatta seriously, right? So you can use it as a verbal strategy, you know, so Milena, may you be well, Bernard, may you be well. Great, that works. But at some deeper level, you do have to question, who is this Milena anyway? Am I this body? Am I these emotions? Am I this personal history? Is my mom in Italy? Right? And then that question takes you to the very kind of direct teaching of what is consciousness? There are the objects of consciousness or awareness, but what is that in itself? And that's when the mind turns to the mind. So if you've listened to Lompa Sumedho's recent, have you heard any of those, his recent Dhamma talks?
No, I haven't.
There's one on his birthday, 27th of July, very powerful, direct speaking that, you know, consciousness is the unconditioned. They're very, very direct that way. And so any form of self-identity with this mind and body is challenged by that teaching. So you don't want to perpetuate that. You don't want to dismiss it. So that's when we talk about relative truth. So relative truth or conventional truth is the conventions of individuality that we all have. And that's true. You know, that I am at Tisserna and you are in Montreal. That's not untrue. But is, you know, that sense of self-identity, is that who, is there a real I there, me, in this experience? And that's what we look into. And each time we look into it, that sense of personhood, you know, vanishes and there's the emptiness of knowing. But it's not vacuity, right? It's vibrant, it's alive, but it isn't self-identified with this mind and body. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. Perfectly.
Again, I don't want to be a wet blanket on these practices of sharing merit and so on. I think they're great, but that's just where I come from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Thank you.
How's Bernard doing?
Oh, he's fine. He's really well.
Is he in China?
No, he's not in China, but he'll be going to Alberta soon to work with an indigenous artist there.
Oh, lovely.
Very excited about that, yeah.
Okay, nice to see you, Milena.
Thank you.
Ajahn, a few questions have appeared.
Thank you.
On the chat line. So the first one is from Beth Bauer. And Beth asks, can you talk a little about ignorance?
About?
Ignorance.
Okay. So in a Buddhist sense, one of the ways we define it is when in that which is impermanent, you see permanence. When that which is not a self-entity, you see a self. And that which is unsatisfactory, you seek satisfactoriness. So it's around the three characteristics. So when in that which is impermanent, you see permanence. So let's say you feel inspired by the, you have a meditation which is really neat, finally. You know, you've been waiting for years. And finally your mind is like blissed out and like, oh yeah, this is what the books are talking about. And I've made it, yeah. And the next day you sit down and your mind is absolute twaddle. You ever had that one? And it just, what happened? I lost it. You took the impermanent experience as being permanent, that's ignorance, and then we suffer. You took it personally, I have attained, and you suffer, and you invested in it a sense of satisfaction that was very short-lived, and it was unsatisfactory. So all experience that arises and ceases is unsatisfactory. It's not bad or ugly or whatever. It's just not the unconditioned. That's a very important one to understand in Buddhism, that a beautiful experience is unsatisfactory. It doesn't mean it's ugly. It just means it will change, right? And because it will change, don't make it more than it is. Enjoy it. Be grateful, but when it changes, say, oh, that's the way it's supposed to be. That's wisdom. So when that sense of attainment ceases and you start to feel self-doubt, you say, oh, it's supposed to change. Happiness is supposed to change to unhappiness. That's wisdom. The other is ignorance. Or not taking it personally. So Ajahn Sumedho's brilliant book. You don't even have to just read the cover. Don't take life personally, right? I mean, who needs to read the book? And see how much you're suffering. You take it personally. And yet there is individuality and there is individual responsibility. That's what you have to get right in Buddhism. If you say, don't take it personally, and then you're not socially responsible, then you don't understand Buddhism. Buddhism has both. It has social responsibility, very strong, strong ethics, strong sense of social norms and commitments and social justice and so on. But what we're trying to find through these teachings about not take it personally is that deep silence behind it all, that deep, deep peace and silence behind it all. So that's one way to define ignorance, or another way is to define not understanding the noble truths, that the cause of suffering is attachment to desire. So say for me, with the fears that I faced and the long time it took me to figure that out, that I thought that the cause of my suffering was the fear, so I ran away from the fear. And I didn't see that the problem was the attached to the fear through desire. And when I saw that, okay, then that's wisdom as opposed to ignorance. So there's a kind of various ways you could talk about it. One way is to not notice the unconditioned, to always be caught up in the conditioned realm, to not notice the unconditioned. There's another way you might talk about it. You got another one there, Vivian?
I do. This one's from Chittasubha. Could Longpo expand on how becoming is a form of desire and how to work with the compulsion of becoming?
Right. So that's the word bhava in bhavatana. So tanha, for those of you who are, just to refresh your minds, a craving has a particular, like, the word desire in English has a broad context. It can be good desire or stupid desire. And so tanha is desire conjoined with ignorance. So the desire to be free from suffering is a wholesome desire. So it's not that all desire is wrong. And then we have biological desire. So the three forms of desire the Buddha asked us to really contemplate was bhava, tanha. So tanha is the word, vibhava, tanha, and kama tanha. So kama tanha is what we call sensual desire, and I just kind of look at that as just the constant consuming of experience. It might be mental experience, it might be video experience, a food experience, or sexual experience, or whatever experience. It's just a kind of consuming of experience, which you can see if you're always doing that, you're not available to the unconditioned because you're absorbed into the conditioned. So it's one way to look at it. And the other is bhava is like the sense of going somewhere, becoming something. And then vibhava is the kind of pushing away or rejection or resistance. So bhava, the way it might arise, specifically in meditation, is around reading too much about attainments. This is a kind of trouble that we get into in Theravada Buddhism. We read the masters, right? You don't read about the losers. You know, you read about the master, and the master's just, you know, like worked his butt off, and then he has this fantastic experience, and you think, I want that. I want a lot of that. And then you read about levels of concentration. And, oh, gosh, I'd like just a bit of that. Thank you very much. And so on and so forth. And then every now and then you actually get, you know, you get a taste of something. Your meditation actually works, and that's just about painful needs. And then you're really in trouble. So from then on, you programmed yourself to either get what the master's got or get what the texts say you should get or get that experience you just had, or the person next to you. I sometimes do interviews, right? this retreat is more difficult. We do interviews of five or six, and then sometimes, not always, you know, people usually talking about the struggles they have in meditation. And every now and one character will come in and like, he's just radiant, or she's radiant, just lit up with insight, right? And everyone else is looking, well, good for you. And then, well, why can't I get some of that? So all of that builds in structures of bhava. I want something. And then that's very insidious, that you sit down with this sort of agenda in the back of your mind, either to repeat the performance you had 2 years ago, or get that level of attainment or concentration, and then the attitude is no longer with awareness, it's with ignorance. And this can quite often not be seen. You know, it's easy to joke about it in this kind of facetious way, because I think we've all been there. But I think we've also seen that you can be really, really trying and not actually notice that you're trying to get something. And that's why the kind of language I'm trying to use is the language of what's it really like now, and just like simple stuff, sound, or wind, you know, or feeling of wind on your face, just very ordinary stuff, to get to that sense of non-becoming. And then what I find is very helpful then in terms of language, you know, in the Noble Eightfold Path, we have right understanding, and then from that you get right thought or right intention. And that kind of thinking for me is not analytical thinking. It's like just popping in the words which remind you of right understanding. So if you understand that the whole project of enlightenment cannot be in time, it does not make any sense, because anything in time has to be born. And if it's born, it will die. So your relationship to time becomes fundamental to your philosophical attitude to this whole business. That freedom or the unconditioned cannot be tomorrow. It cannot be in the future. It's not possible. It can only be akalika dhamma, here and now, not a matter of time. And you know, you go through that logic in your, I did, I think we all do. It can't be, it has to be here and now. And that begins to underpin all your attitudes and the efforts you're making. So if you start to notice you're trying to get something, well, it can't be. It can't be it. So you're undercutting the whole sense of me in time becoming something. And then that insight, which is then is a part of right understanding, that then serves your thinking processes. And then your thinking processes are now impelled or assisted or directed, intended by those right understandings. And so then you start to use language which enunciates or makes conscious your right understanding. You're coming back to right understanding. So you say to yourself, non-becoming. It's not like a whole train of thought, I should meditate just to be here and now, and I shouldn't try to get anywhere. That's self-view, right? Now, Virudhamma, you behave yourself. You mustn't do that. This isn't self-view. This is awakening thought, right thought. So non-becoming. And then you get a feel for non-becoming. Non-resistance. Non-resistance. Non-consuming, if you want. And then maybe that language doesn't work for you. You know, maybe you need another word, or you need to refresh the word after a year or whatever. But you can see the point of it, right? You're trying to refresh your insights. You know, like on a computer, you get the refresh button, right? And the site becomes refreshed. I don't know if it feels better, but you do that with your own insights. You refresh them by using language, non-becoming. I've seen that. I've understood that, non-becoming. And you can see all that language then brings you into akalika dhamma, here and now dhamma, not a matter of time. Huh? Now, there are other forms of becoming, worldly forms of becoming. So the, one of the questions people ask, well, what about, what's the word? What's another word for becoming? Another English word? Achievement. So like achievement, something like that, right? Well, that's very ambitious, like ambition, achievement, ambition. Well, what about that? You're just going to, you know, live under a rock the rest of your life and just watch the turtles? Is achievement wrong? Well, like building a monastery, that's a crazy idea, isn't it? You know, no money here in the northlands of Ontario, well, central Ontario. What a crazy idea. It's very ambitious. It's a very ambitious idea. But the ambition can be from goodness, from responsibility, from I want to put food on my table for the kids so they can go to university. I want to do that for them. That can be very good ambition, right? So then we have vocation and skill and that. So we develop skills and ambitions, so on, but they don't have to be egotistical. So then the vocation that you have in order to take care of your kids, take care of the family, feed the monks, whatever you want, take care of the environment, the vocation becomes your monastery. Your family is your monastery, isn't it? Your livelihood is your monastery. That's where you learn. I learn here, you learn there. And then it can be ambition. I'd like to get better skills in being a professor at the university, or better skills at gardening, or that doesn't really matter. And you look into YouTube and you get better at gardening, or better at woodwork, or better at whatever. So that, you know, the whole becoming thing isn't kind of a recipe for becoming some kind of a, uninteresting and boring person. You know, there is beauty and there is culture and there is art. That can all be very, very uplifting and very helpful. But it's the whole, the sense that the spiritual dimension that the Buddha portrays for us is in time. That's the problem. That's not true. Worldly skills are in time. So if I want to learn how to do woodwork better, I need to study, I need to work, I need to make mistakes. So the development of skill is in time. The development of meditation, you could say, is in time. You get better at it. But the realization, that spiritualization is here and now, not a matter of time. So you're like, the meditation skills you're developing is not to get something later, but to be better at knowing now, if you see what I mean. And that's what we mean by Akalika Dhamma. You know that story you told about the Latvians? The Latvian lady that yelled at us at the Latvian retreat? We're walking. I was thinking of the word which someone gave to me. We're like, you know, when we're doing walking meditation, we're like ambulatory catatonics. That's a good word. Isn't that great? Next question, sorry.
Okay, this is from Karen. How do you know, how do you discern whether to leave a situation or to stay with it and just accept the suffering around it and deal with it?
Yeah, it's life, isn't it? When do you retreat? there's no answer, but one consideration is, if a situation is abusive, get out of there if you can, obviously. But also, if the situation is so overwhelming that you cannot be aware and mindful, then you're heading for trouble, because then the compounding of whatever stress you're experiencing is going to get even more compounded. So that's one criteria. Like, if you think about burnout, what happens is the person no longer has enough awareness to grow in the complexity. So that would be one thing. Do you have awareness that you can grow through the situation, or is it so overwhelming? But then the other considerations of social responsibility, they're very complex. You know, kids and finances, and they're very, very complex. So there's no easy answer. But to look at, I suppose you look at things like I should be doing something. Be careful of that one. You know, that I should be a certain way. Maybe the cultural norms which are putting pressure on you to do something. Or just the fear of insecurity, those kinds of things. Get in contact with the underlying resistance to this situation. Why is it like that? But there's no easy answer. That situation that I got kind of burnt out in that I just spoke of, I should have got out of that much earlier. I just got so overwhelmed by it that I didn't see what was happening to me. So there is, you know, like there is strategic retreat. And the idea that every kind of stress you have that you should face and grow in it is an absolute which you should not hold to. You know, like I really have to push through this or I'll get stronger. You might not. You might be crushed by it. So look at that. Look at like the sort of absolutist heroic mindset, which I have to, that's not, that's just another sense of self and personality, which might be culturally inculcated into you. But then, you know, there's so much in that. So if you can get to the underlying self view there, I suppose, huh? And have a look at it. But if you're exhausted and you're just like crying all the time and, you know, that kind of extremes of burnout, then you need space. You need help, right? They're very, very important. But again, how do you know? Not sure. Yeah. Kalyanamitta. That's the place, isn't it? Kalyanamitta, spiritual friends. When you can go to spiritual friends who you know won't necessarily give you an easy answer, right? And you can bounce it off of them, and they're not going to preach to you, or they're really, really friends, and you get some external person. That's very, very important. Kalyanamitta, very important, because you know you don't want to be alone with those things. And then you get a body of information around you and protection to make those decisions. Like the Sangha life, our life is like, you know, it's based on spiritual friendship. We're not, our Vinaya is not really designed for solitude. Monks like solitude, they like that, but our Vinaya is designed for community and Kalyanamitta so that we can help each other. One more, Vivian, do you have? Or are we done?
Well, there's one. This one's from Chow. Dear Ajahn, thank you for the ATP so chanting. Can you please explain about the four pairs of persons, the eight kinds of noble beings in the chant?
Yeah, that's the four levels of attainment. So stream entry, once return and non-return and arahant. And the kind of literature, the commentary literature is that there's two phases of that. Magga and Pala. So it's very complex, but it's talking about, you know, we use the word Arya, which is pre-Third Reich. The word Aryan comes from India. It doesn't come from Germany. It precedes it. Unfortunately, this chap in Germany kind of ruined the word, but my friends in Indian culture still enjoy the word Aryan, and it means noble. It doesn't mean white supremacist. And is that true? He's laughing. So the word Aryan is used in Theravada Buddhism. And these four levels are the Aryans, right? But it's a very uncomfortable word to use nowadays. So I don't never use it because... but so those are the Aryan disciples or the noble disciples of the Buddha who have there's an entry into what the deathless is about. And then there's a diminution of all the confusion of greed and hatred and more refinements until the arahant is the one who is fully awakened. So if you'd like to... Chow, you've probably read this, I think, but if you go to Lompo Liam's biography in the book No Worries, I think he is Arya. That's the way we talk about it in monk language. Sometimes he's Arya, and I think he's fully attained from what he says in that statement. So if you want to read that, then you get a sense of it. The first stream entry is around what we call the three fetters, and they are personality view, vichikicca doubt, and silabhata paramasa, which is belief in rites and rituals. And personality view is taking it personally. So when I have, and when I'm feeling angry at someone, and I'm rabbiting away with self-view, that was idiots, I'm never going to forgive them, that's personality view. When I see anger as anger, then I'm in a stream of dharma. Okay? Doubt. When I don't really have faith in awareness, and I just keep going to doubt and trying to figure it out, and I don't have faith in awareness of change, that blocks me, and I'm in the stream of thought all the time, thinking. And if I think my spiritual practice is a time-bound practice, which will then get me enlightened later on, that's a ritual. All rituals and superstitions are about time. I make obeisance to the deity. The deity looks out for me in the future. Huh? And one of the superstitions we would have are kind of attachment to a kind of way of practice, and that way of practice will get me something called enlightenment. That's one way of looking at it. So it's not superstitious in the usual way, but it's still bound by time. It's bound by time. Anyway, that's a huge topic, and it's a bit late, isn't it, for that? So perhaps we could finish there, and let's do the Metta Bhavana chant as a way of finishing this evening. If you would look that up. This is what should be done as the opening line. This is what should be done
by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings please. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, young or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection, This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to his use, the pure hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.